I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So today's interview is about cotton. I know, it sounds kind of dull, it sounds kind of interesting, but the reality is that most of what you're wearing is probably made of cotton. I know it is for me. We're talking today to a professor out of the University of Guelph who's written a new book called, interestingly enough, Cotton, Adam Snaid. He's a political scientist, he's a good guy, he's got a great sense of humor, and he's also an international development scholar and quite an expert when it comes to commodities. So you're going to enjoy this interview, period. We talk about cotton. We talk about this, fabric of our lives. We talk about how... What does it mean to be an ethical consumer? What does it mean to actually shop, you know, with some sort of idea about others in mind? I mean, how odd is that? We talk about clothing poverty and being better consumers, being better citizens. We talk about the Better Cotton Initiative. We talk about organic cotton and about anti-globalization. You're going to love this interview. So do stay tuned and check out Adam's book, Cotton. You can find it online. It's Adam Snaid coming right up. Don't forget davidpecklive.com for more interviews. And also about my book, Real Change is Incremental, and also about opportunities to book me as a public speaker. And don't forget rabble.ca for even more interviews from me, but also from others as well. Coming right up, Adam Snaid, and we're talking about cotton. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today, Associate Professor Adam Snaid at the University of Guelph, in fact, on campus. And Adam, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, David.
Yeah, no problem. So I was going to pronounce your name Snead, but then, of course, you quickly corrected me before the recorder was on. Rhymes with laid or paid. So we got that sorted out right out of the gate.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, it's good. So we're going to talk, I think, about a whole lot of things. Looking forward to this conversation for quite a while. But your latest book, Cotton, it's hard to know what it's about. Based on the title,
well, the resources series that it falls in is pretty straight up. So yeah, the other titles in the series are all one term: coffee, oil, diamonds, and the idea, I think, behind the series is really to for authors to peel back the politics of whichever resource or commodity they're writing about.
So John Perkins, who I'm a huge fan of, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, one of my favorite books of all time, says, quote, "An important expose of the cotton industry that opens our eyes to the way many businesses manipulate the media and all of us. A telling example of why we all should look for and expose the story behind the story," close quote. I mean, there's so much going on just in that quote alone. We could talk about the story behind the story. I mean, mm-hmm. I think, you know, and so many places to start, but... And I want to get to your afterword, because in a way we should almost be talking only about that to me in the book. But tell me, what is political economy?
Well, I think it's a recognition that if you approach the study of a resource or a commodity from a purely economics kind of a lens, you might miss out on some of the situation of the economics of that resource in politics. So I guess it's political economy is just a simple recognition of the fundamental inseparability of politics and economics. When you try to do an analysis, you need to always take account of both at the same time, and it's methods or analytical tools to help students, to help people across society really understand the linkages and the fundamental connections between politics and economics.
As you look back as an academic and, you know, your time in Australia, and maybe we'll talk about that and what you've, the traveling you've done and so on, would you say you've always been a bit of a political economist?
Well, I think one of the first formative experiences here was just finishing high school and being able to attend the New Democratic National Convention at a very dark time for the party. I think it was 1997, so I was it was in Regina. And I was reading some books by Jim Laxer around the time. And I think reading James Laxer's books, I really got a sense for, okay, wait a second. You might need to look at both politics and economics together if you want to get to the story behind the story.
You talk about in the book about meeting somebody, and it's having a conversation. And I think the line is, what was fascinating for me was the kind of, I guess, the implications, the splash and ripple effect. I mean, obviously, you've been thinking about all these things. There was a bit of a tipping point. There was a bit of an edge of this conversation that led to Cotton. Mm. You know, and you say, I was hooked after this particular... Can
Absolutely.
You tell me about that story? Because clearly there's a... I'm always fascinated. I mean, talk about the story behind the story. It apparently started with a person, which I think is amazing.
It did. I mean, I was finishing up my master's degree at York University, working with Daniel Drache, who was an eminent political economist of Canada's resource economies. And I got on the subway to my phone was broken, and I ended up in one of the cell phone stores at Yorkdale Mall, having a conversation with somebody else who had just finished a master's degree about their family in Uganda and the challenges that they were facing with respect to cotton, and I was totally hooked because I had just finished this project on the historic efforts of developing countries to try to make world trade work better for development across the global south. So there was kind of a dovetail. Well, this cotton issue in the global south seems to be pretty prominent, and this individual here is telling me a direct link. So it was a relational thing from that point forward, and that's where I went with my PhD to study.
Well, I just love the importance of the average in the everyday, you know, the extraordinary in what appears to be a meaningless subway conversation.
Right.
Right? Yeah. It kind of changed the course of your life in some regards. Mm-hmm. And yet you wouldn't have got there had you not had the history, probably, right? Mm-hmm. Had you not been doing the work at York and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I could have just gone on in a more academic direction, but
right.
I think by having that relational, that kind of moment, I was able to focus my studies on something that I knew really mattered for people outside of the university. And that I think from that point forward, it was all about, okay, using academic tools in order to explain and speak to real-world challenges.
So you're a professional academic, and yet, can I say, is it fair to say there's a little bit of a tone with respect to academia in the book, the way you approach it? Not a disregard or a disrespect, but an acknowledgement maybe of its limitations? Is that...
Well, I don't think I'm under any illusions. I don't think many academics at this point are under any illusion to having the truth, the sole
right.
story.
Right.
I mean,
right.
we have lots of tools that can help us to get closer to reality. But yeah, I think in especially in my field and studying global resources, global commodities, there are many people who don't acknowledge the biases that they bring to the table. And so maybe that's the tone you're talking about a little.
Well, page one, how about the sole root, the hard knowledge, right?
Yeah.
You talk about students asserting abstract mathematical models, right?
Mm-hmm.
First paragraph.
Yeah, well, as a political economist, that's what I'm up against.
Yeah.
I'm up against very convincing other academics that have different approaches to knowledge. And I'm pushing back against that in a way, I think, yes.
In a way that Is it about the theory, the theoretical, practical for you? I mean, you've spent, from what I know about your history and so on, you've spent a fair bit of time on the ground. You've connected, taking those. Let's talk about story behind the story.
Right.
You've been in country. You've been on panels. You've been, invited to speak, et cetera. Tell me about that sort of gap or lack thereof.
Well, I think one of the best pieces of advice I had going through my PhD from a professor was, don't keep doing the same academic thing. Don't keep going to the same academic conference year after year after year. Like, get out there, do something well, do it once, do it right, and then move on to something else. Meet new people, have new experiences. So that's been part of the process of becoming an academic studying political economy, is just to constantly do something once, do it well, and move to the next thing. I think that opens up a different kind of a world than if you just continually keep doing the same thing.
Do you think academics to some degree live in a bubble of a sort? And I mean, obviously, it's really always kind of unfair to just lob these types of questions out because of what they sort of assume and presuppose. But I read somewhere recently, it was maybe a business book, I don't know, an article talking about how, you really do need to surround yourself with people of different faiths and different ideas and different belief systems and ideologies and politics to expand your horizon,
sure.
I suppose. Reach out.
Well, the University of Guelph is absolutely prioritizing this kind of a thing, this kind of engagement, whether it's community within the city of Guelph, whether it's globally. I mean, some of my colleagues have established incredible global connections in terms of engagement beyond just publishing academic articles, beyond just looking to speak to the community of academics around the world that are behind paywalls, publishing behind, $90 an article kind of stuff.
Get out from behind your keyboard.
Yeah, exactly. And use the tools that you're learning about to actually work with people to help them to either better their lives, to understand the situation that they find themselves in. I think this is something that the university here has prioritized, and that's why I guess we're here.
Do you think that's where global sort of political change really starts to happen? I mean, obviously, it's got to be top-down, it's got to be bottom-up, it's got to be, grassroots and the two meeting somewhere in the middle, I suppose, and embracing and including. But are big changes happening in the universities? This is where the ideas sort of are, germinating, and then are hopefully passed on through conferences, through papers. Those few people that are reading those articles then say, well, hang on a minute here. We're onto something, and we're getting to your book really shortly, because I think your book really does bridge that divide to me.
Well, I think it's incumbent upon people who are employed by universities to be academics, to be researchers, to be teachers, to do service to that university and the community, actually be able to use their knowledge to speak to bigger, broader social issues. And in the case of this recent work, I think the book here is a little more open than it might be if I was writing specifically to an academic audience. I wrote it with my third year undergrads in mind, as an attempt to try to help them to think through some of the intersections between politics and economics on a particular commodity. And that's not an academic article in a top journal. It's not a, but it's a different kind of a knowledge product, if we can use that expression.
Interesting. Yeah. Is it, well, you're very honest about that in the book too.
Yeah.
About the fact that maybe you were at a conference, you gave a paper, and you sounded to me like you were a little disappointed at the lack of interaction, and yet ultimately it led places because of the non-academic approach, but it was an article you had on a blog.
Right.
And this is amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is bridging to me that divide and getting the real work into the real world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're talking about some alleged fraud in ethical cotton, I believe.
Yes, and, which is a nice segue into what the book is all about. And by the way, I was totally joking, obviously. The book's called Cotton. Yeah. It doesn't really need a subtitle, does it? Yeah.
The geopolitics of your life.
is it really as bad as you lay out?
Well, I mean, the challenges are stark.
The blood is on the fabric of our lives.
Yeah, it's the fabric of lives. The fabric of our lives has been covered by blood for centuries. There's no question. Now, that's something that Sven Beckert, the eminent historian from Harvard, who's been widely praised for his book Empire of Cotton last year. I mean, this was nominated for a Pulitzer. He's been traveling around the world, and many historians that have been focusing on the connections between slavery, subsidizing the development of capitalism, have now come in to it with economists who have a different viewpoint on the connections between slavery and capitalism. And I seem to think that Beckert and the historians have it right, that in terms of the history of cotton, and this book is not about the history of cotton, it's about the politics, but there is some history in there. And yeah, absolutely. So I'm not...
So if it really is the fabric of our lives, I mean, we're, you know, your cotton is probably more sustainably sourced than the cotton I'm wearing. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that, but maybe not. How, and listen, I've thought about this kind of stuff about social change and about how do you get students to, never mind students, how do you get folks thinking about things differently? And I think isn't that what the academic world really should be all about? You know, challenging people, asking those questions. My background in philosophy, I'm more interested in the question than the answer, for heaven's sakes. And yet, you want it to lead to something practical.
Yeah.
So is it about a t-shirt made at the right place? Is it about a suit that has been sourced properly? Or am I oversimplifying?
Well, I think this is the new, what you're talking about is the new normal. If you just go on to Twitter and you look at the ethical supply chain conversations that are taking place with respect to commodities like cotton, you're going to see that there are big companies talking about sustainability in their supply chain. You're going to see small companies talking about how their sustainability in their cotton supply chain. And community engagement and better lives for people. So it's not so you got big businesses talking about it, and they don't talk about it in the same way. They don't talk about sustainability or development in the same ways as smaller small medium enterprises that have different kinds of business models, social enterprises, stuff that's come out of philanthropic interventions, organic cotton, fair trade cotton. There's just a huge differentiation of what ethical even means when it comes to cotton. So I try to lay that out so that people at least have a tool with which to analyze, okay, so there's some politics here. I've got every actor in the cotton chain wants to present themselves as being ethical. And how do I evaluate those claims?
Why did it get so complicated? I mean, what little I know of it, and your book is really helpful, and what little I do know of trade, I suppose, it's. I mean, I've looked into the coffee, the whole coffee thing.
You know,
second most traded commodity next to oil. Yeah. It's brutal, right? What goes on and what doesn't go on, speaking of ethics. But... And it's complicated.
Oh yeah, well, the complications I think come from, and this is across all internationally traded commodities from the 1970s. There were concerted efforts within the United Nations system in the 1970s to create international commodity arrangements. So mechanisms for coffee, for example, that existed in the 1980s, supply arrangements where countries sat down at the table that produced coffee with countries that imported coffee, and there were some discussions about price. There were discussions about quality. And this sort of happened or was floated to happen for cotton, but never really got off the ground. But the world changed, right? From the 1970s to the 1980s, you're talking about a world with many more actors connected fundamentally across borders in new ways. So the internet, globalization changed. Lots of new actors having an impact on the supply chain. In the 1970s, it wasn't the case that very many people were employed talking about making cotton work better for people or the planet. And this is a huge growth part of the industry now. So I think you're talking about a profusion of actors. And that's the complication. That's the complexity. And I think there are some political economy theories. Robert Cox at York University, the eminent international relations theorist, I rely on him a lot in this book to try to map out the specific changes in cotton that made it so complex. And then I try to speak about that complexity in a way that at least can, I hope, be understood by people who are just trying to make decisions about cotton in their lives.
In a few years, I see the updated version of this having a chapter called Trump, Trade, and Truth. I went there as you were talking about all of this and started thinking about the subsidies of American cotton farmers and the billions of dollars. And you talk about Brazil, and there's some pretty interesting things that went on there, and the payoffs almost in the cotton industry, and happy to go there if you like. But you brought up globalization. So you say, quote, and by globalization, I do not mean liberalization, privatization, deregulation, or other phenomena associated with now out-of-fashion market fundamentalism. You must have had your tongue in cheek for while you wrote some of this. Globalization is about much more than the controversial basket of neoliberal economic policies that became known as the Washington Consensus or the Golden Straitjacket, close quote.
Yeah.
So what what pray tell is globalization?
Well, I think it's part of it is the cliche, faster, smaller world. Mm. Part of it is integration of people's lives across borders, so more intense connections between people in different geographical locations around the world, and more extensive, so more different kinds of connections. So Jan Aart Scholte, who's a political theorist in the UK, for years has been talking about this understanding of globalization being much more than deep trade, financial, or investment integration across borders.
Adam, typically when people say globalization, it's pejorative, it's negative, there's a tone, right?
Yes.
Typically.
Yeah.
That's not what I'm hearing right now.
No, I think that it's change. I mean, it shapes international development. It shapes the kinds of it shapes poverty reduction, inequality. And globalization isn't necessarily a bad, but when it's discussed publicly, oftentimes people look at economic integration as being equivalent to globalization, and I think no. There's a heck of a lot more going on here than just that. I think it's the tongue-in-cheek thing. I think we're trying to speak to, in some cases, the media, which is not caught up to this. The idea that globalization is a much bigger fundamental phenomenon than people think at the surface.
And for those of folks who might care, was there a little jab at Thomas Friedman there in that definition?
Well, I think the Lexus and the Olive Tree was a pretty influential attempt at a political economy analysis at the height of the Clinton era neoliberalism.
So if it's the fabric of our lives, if it's splattered in blood, what can I do about that? What can listeners do about that? What can people who read Cotton do about that? Or for you, is it more about awareness?
Well, I think there are some very simple steps that somebody could take as a consumer or a citizen, and I think those things shouldn't be mutually exclusive. I think consumer citizens are an important part of the piece of sustainability and development in 2016, 2017 now.
Do you feel like you've sort of though given up something by calling people consumers at all?
Yeah, well, I mean, people have to clothe themselves and say, sure. So there is a debate. The used clothing industry around the world is so massive. And one of the big things that many people often think, okay, if I give away my clothes, this is good. And Andrew Brooks in England wrote a book the other year about clothing poverty and this used clothing trade, which is just dumping tons of clothes on developing countries.
Warehouses, mountains of clothes.
One of the things that ethically, morally in your own life, if I have too many clothes and I give those away, do I know if those are going to be going to a country where maybe that country could be producing clothes itself? And now they're clothed in our old clothes. So there are lots of relations that are very difficult here. But it's even just going to the store or ordering something online. How do I know that that cotton has met particular standards for sustainability, for reduced pesticide use or no pesticide use? How do I know? Well, labels, standards and codes. Organic production is competing directly right now with a business industry-supported code called the Better Cotton Initiative. They are not the same thing. Many industry big companies are absolutely trying to convince the public that better cotton is more sustainably produced cotton, and maybe we can grant them yes, it is a little better than large scale monocultures with heavy pesticide intense operations. But I do think that organic is a source of innovation and entrepreneurship in cotton. So if you are thinking like a citizen and you're willing to get away from price, to not think about the price of the underwear that you're buying as the first priority, to think about the quality of the, say, ingredients that went into those underpants.
After your book came out, you tweeted, I think, that made a crack about the underpants of, was it the WTO folks sitting at the table?
Cotton has literally been under the pants of all politicians of world historical significance.
Right.
And that's the reality is that if we need to think about our underpants. I mean, the politics...
I spend little time thinking about my underwear, just for the record.
Yeah. Well, this is the reality of the world that we're in. I mean, now people are really paying attention to the coffee that they're drinking.
Adam, isn't this globalization? Isn't this one of the benefits that people are thinking about their underwear in a way that they haven't before?
Absolutely. And there are opportunities for innovative, like Pact Apparel, for example. I'll just throw a plug out there. I mean, like they've got certified organic cotton underwear. You know, and you can see the difference in the quality of life from the presentation that they make on their website of the families in the community that are actually growing the stuff and how this is being produced. And I think that's the kind of innovation and entrepreneurship which is really enabling job opportunities that are many times over the kind of job opportunities that exist on a large scale cotton monoculture for the bulk market.
So for you, this is so not an academic exercise, clearly, as the book lays out and as our conversation here is laying out. Is this an ethical thing for you? I dinner with a friend last night who's become a vegan. Mm. It's not ethical at all. Period. I mean, right. I asked him flat out, oh, yeah, no, it has nothing to do, mm-hmm. And he made some kind of deeply unethical joke. And said, no, it's all health. And then later in the evening said, made a comment about how, my grocery bill's gone way down. Mm. Oh, great. So this is just about economics, is it?
Yeah. Excellent. Well, no, I think it's not about being sanctimonious. It's about actually trying to call out power. Power is something that we don't really talk a lot about in the media scape right now, and actually paying attention to who has the power to control narratives on development and sustainability. You need the tools to be able to understand how your approach to the world might be manipulated by large organizations. John Kenneth Galbraith famously wrote in the 1960s about the power of big organizations over the lives of consumers and the power of big organizations to control consumer decisions. And this is very controversial. Lots of economists didn't like it, but I think he had a lot going on there. And in this book, I tried to give anybody that reads it the tools to be able to understand how they might be subject to manipulation or control.
Is that what you resonated with Klein's No Logo? I mean, I love this, the way you tell the story about, I took out the black magic marker and I blocked out the logo, the brand on my jacket, my Gore-Tex jacket.
That's right. I should have.
Yeah. Your $300 Gore-Tex jacket.
That's right.
I couldn't help but laugh. I don't have, Gore-Tex is not a cheap.
It was back in the 1990s, but absolutely. I think there was some resonance, but William Grider as well, who was the old editor of Rolling Stone, political economist in the U.S. context. These books at that time, I think, were pretty formative. As a young student without any kind of real future plan in my mind, I was tree planting in Canada. I was bouncing around trying to.
How much did you make per tree? 13.
Oh, it depends. I mean, in Ontario at that time, it was about
good money, man.
7 to 9 cents a tree in Ontario, but BC, Vancouver Island in February,
man,
that was up to 30.
You guys needed to unionize. I just 7 to 9 cents. A
well,
tree,
the union the union no gigs were I think a little more plush, but
that's a lot of trees, man. You got to plant.
I'm about 800 or 900,000. I think I put in, but I mean that's.
That's hilarious.
Piecework.
That's a campaign for something.
Basis, right? But I think you're mentioning the political economy that came out in the 1990s, that kind of ultra globalization, anti globalization, Maude Barlow, Tony Clark. There were a ton of young people on university campuses across this country, and that's where I came from.
Wasn't that a calling out of power, really?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the implications of the end of the Clinton era in terms of the WTO in 1999, the World Bank protests in 2000, what happened in Quebec City the following year around the summit of the Americas, there were a lot of young people, Teamsters and Turtles, coming together with young people to think about the way the world was going and the kind of almost the overwhelming contributions of just neoliberal economics or neoclassical economics to informing what leaders were saying at that time was very problematic for me. So I think there was a way, and that comes out in the book
Are there any passive commodities?
What do you mean by that?
Well, you refer to the idea that cotton not being passive, and the sense I got was, everything we do affects somebody else. So every purchase I make, every coffee that's not, fairly traded and so on, has an impact on the economy, on globalization, has an impact on others. It has an impact on men and women and boys and girls around the world. And I think that's a way of, for me anyway, kind of injecting a little bit more humanity into this idea of my purchases. Because honestly, I kind of don't give a rat's ass about the underwear I like.
Right. Yeah.
But clearly, I need to start.
Yeah, and this is the challenge, I think, from younger generations of the last 15 years in Canadian university campuses. Fair trade coffee has been the new normal for students to be okay. Yeah, I've got to make sure that I drink that. And I think there's a generational issue that's happening here where students are coming out of university really concerned about how the world is working, especially those with a social science background, right. And thinking, okay, well, in my own life and the decisions that I make, how can I actually help others to lead lives that they might value more? And I think one of those ways is to pay attention to the consumption decisions that you do make. And that's important for me. I mean, I know that you don't want to think about your underwear. And there were many arguments in the late 1990s about, if we do define all the problems of the world down to our socks and our underwear, maybe we're not going to get very far, right?
Right.
Yeah, we might miss the forest. We might get caught up in these individual trees, so to speak.
But I love that notion of passive active.
Cotton is described as a soft commodity by the industry, right? But it's the hardest to grow, and you can't eat it. I mean, so there's even linguistic issues or terminology that's a problem when it comes to these things.
That comment about how I could taste the bitterness of the cotton in that line of that paragraph when you talk about that idea of not being able to eat it.
Yeah,
is it pretty? And it's. Is it undervalued? No, it's not undervalued, but it's underappreciated. Is that a fair question?
Well, I mean, there are many other substitute fibers. You know, it's not the only game in town. And hemp and linen, wool, I mean, we don't necessarily need the stuff. Mm. There's an industry that's weaved up with maintaining the stuff in our lives. Every organization that moves cotton has an interest in maintaining it. And you can't expect an industry to produce information that's going to undermine the industry. There are players within. I mean, when Neil Young came out the other year and said, I'm only going to be buying organic cotton, and he was immediately demonized by high-level consultants in the industry saying, okay, this guy is trying to undercut the cotton industry. And he just was called out and raked over the coals in a bunch of industry publications for having the audacity to question the model. So there are many people with an interest in maintaining a very problematic status quo here, and that's what the book really focuses on.
So I spent a fair bit of time in Cambodia. Garment industry, huge in Cambodia. In fact, without it, a lot of people would probably starve. How do you answer that, I guess, that conservative critic that says, well, it's better than nothing?
Okay. Well, I think different models for industrial production are where development and sustainability will be achieved in the cotton supply chain over the next 20 years.
So there isn't one solution?
There is not. No, there are multiple overlapping and in some ways conflicting approaches. Mm-hmm. I mean, the old large-scale industrial model with smaller hands, highly gendered production systems with lots of worker insecurity. Yeah. Jeff Ballinger, the anti-sweatshop expert, has called this out since his initial studies in Indonesia in the 1990s. That is a model. It's still in play in places like Cambodia, and people do continue to get their heads knocked outside of factories when there are strikes. And the challenge, I think, for cotton-producing countries is to figure out what ways that model is past the use-by date, and what new kind of more ethical, organic, and fair trade, smaller scale, craft type, artisanal scale production might yield in terms of employment generation. So actually, I think there's a huge unrealized opportunity at this point to basically recreate an industrial model for cotton that draws on artisanal and is informed by craft industries and actually employs people and not in the kind of factory drudgery context. And this could actually yield a way different cotton system.
What I love about the book and about our conversation is you don't I'm sure you tend towards the cynical from time to time.
Yes.
How could you not when you're doing geopolitical analysis? But you sound pretty hopeful.
Well, I think it's clear that 15 years ago, I couldn't walk into downtown Guelph, let's say, and find myself a pair of organic jeans or socks. I couldn't go online and actually find detailed accounts of what 10 different organic cotton operators are doing in terms of their community interventions, in terms of the price that people are being paid at the farm gate, in terms of the training women are getting to actually tick the boxes related to organic standards, and how that has enhanced literacy and different approaches to fertilization and pest control that don't involve agrochemicals. I mean, like the innovation that's taking place on some of these farms, this wasn't really there. This is learning
all
by
benefits
doing.
Benefits of globalization too. To some
absolutely,
degree, right?
I mean, with in the case of Tanzania's successful organic cotton cultivation, you're talking about Indian and Swiss consultants working together with Tanzanians to develop new approaches to compost, new approaches to trap crops. I mean, you've got in Tanzania farmers that grow organic cotton that now can read, that have sunflowers that trap the crops that would otherwise be eating their cotton. Now they have sunflower oil for sale. Now they have new kinds of botanical pesticides. So they're growing crops to use as pest control. It's incredible to see the changes that are taking place. So you can't be cynical. This is people working together across borders. So in a lot of ways, globalization is really delivering us a more ethical cotton system, but the conventional bulk market stuff is still pretty covered in blood.
So it's not just a matter of time, because really time changes nothing. Yeah. I mean, you've got to change opinion, you've got to go deeper. I mean, we're talking about our underwear, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, yeah.
Things are happening, right? Mm-hmm. So it's got to be more. I mean, this is about choice, it seems to me. You know.
Well, there are choices that consumers do make, but again, like those choices are subject to limits. So, for example, the Better Cotton Initiative, the industry-supported initiative to make cotton more ethical or sustainable, that initiative basically enables companies that are part of it to produce advertising in any way they see fit regarding the benefits of better cotton. Whereas if it's organic, there's a third party that's been accredited by an international accreditation agency to actually evaluate whether the cotton that's in there has met standards for organic production. So like the control systems for organic cotton are far superior, but the ability for large companies to just say that they're doing more ethical cotton without any of that kind of control system in place, I think is still
happening. So for the big corporations, you can still make money and be ethical?
Well, some of them. I mean, H&M has got a lot of organic. I think at one point, even Sam's Club was sourcing a lot of organic cotton. The numbers are difficult, like
yeah,
with all
sure.
To actually lock down. But there's been a pretty pretty steady upwards increase.
It's such a tough call, you know. I mean, everyone loves to hammer Walmart and so on, and yet a company like this that clearly isn't going too far anywhere too soon changes their fluorescent light fixtures and takes one lamp out of them, and all of a sudden, you know, look at the environmental shift as a result of that. And so you kind of have to applaud that in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to applaud that.
No, incremental changes are important.
Yeah.
And whether it's, uniform industry producers switching and saying, you know, we're gonna use a different kind of fiber here or fabric from a producer that has these standards and codes
sure.
in place.
Yeah. Yeah.
This stuff is happening, and that's all good as far as I'm concerned. But what I'm most fearful of is just the control that empowered individuals within an industry continue to exert over the narrative about that industry, and the kind of rearguard efforts to brand cotton is, oh yeah, and cotton doesn't have any food problems. I mean, the acreage under cotton is shrinking over time. And the reality is most of the rotation crops of cotton are being rendered into biofuels. There is a food issue underlying conventional cotton. And organic cotton, you can grow that in rotations with many food crops, so the food security inherently on an organic cotton operation is enhanced for the producer and probably the community around it versus a large-scale monoculture operation.
So we're kind of back to the soft commodity critique, are we not? I mean, this is far more important than we realize. A whole lot more going on than meets the eye. I mean,
sure.
That's one of the takeaways from your book, isn't it?
I mean, another aspect of this is the financialization. I mean, and this isn't just, cotton is just one little tiny piece of that, but the overall size of the industry has just been jacked upwards over the last 20 years with the financialization. So companies that are commodity traders are in many ways making much more money on the financial side, so futures, options, speculation of direction of future price, yielding far more value for commodity traders than the actual physical trade itself. And this is the very difficult part of the book, the chapter where I'm dealing with finance. And this is something that many others working on political economy issues have been attentive to. Yeah, and this is in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. Just the sheer number, the volume of financial instruments just kind of outpacing the size of the physical trade, and traders now having an interest in the financial side of their businesses in a much more clear way, driving their businesses than maybe the actual physical trade. This is a very difficult area. You have to tread very carefully. You can't make very large statements about it or claims without very detailed research and analysis. But it is a big problem, this financialization of commodities.
You're kind of talking about futures, are you not? Mm-hmm. Sort of the digitization of capital.
Yes.
In a sense.
Yeah.
Right?
In a lot of ways.
Fake trades.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you don't hold any physical asset and you can still trade in the futures, well, this is the industry wants to be able to do this.
Of course.
They've convinced Commodity Futures Trading Commission that this is the reality, that it should still be the case. Position limits? Who needs those, right?
So freedom, choice, responsibility, ethics, all of these kind of concerns. Sadly, we're going to have to wrap it up in a couple of minutes here. But these younger people, I can say that because of my age, but students coming out of, seem to care, the no logo folk. Are they at some point just going to say, I have three kids now, I just need cheap cotton. I'm going to go shop at maybe Sam's Club.
Well, this is it. I mean, like, so
when the rubber meets the road, the financial challenges of raising a family, does it go out the door, or do prices come down over time? And it's,
well, I mean, demand and supply have to meet here in the ethical market at some point. So there will be much more supply coming on over the next 5 years. There's been a lot of venture capital. I mean, even some of the Canadian banks have been fantastic in fronting a ton of money to organizations that are taking different approaches to everything from growing vegetables to making beer. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity for young people to actually develop business models and social enterprises to approach sources of finance and say, hey, look, like this commodity, we can do this better. We can do this in a different way, and we can probably build our life around it. So I think in some ways, we also, in the Canadian context, I mean, here we are heavily indebted across the society, our mortgage debt, our consumer debt, it's big time. But we have that. We have the financial capacity through debt to be able to make decisions. So when I was a student on student loans, I would still buy the more expensive fair trade coffee. I went into debt as a student to drink ethical coffee, and that was a decision that I made. That was kind of my normative, political. I can do this because I have the access to capital. And everybody across this, across this economy that has access to a loan can make that choice too. Even if you don't have any money. Now that voting with your dollars is a big problem, though, because some people do have, and this is the other hand, a lot more, votes related to their lot more dollars. Yeah.
So just before we wrap it up, I would imagine most of the students here are not going into debt to buy fairly traded coffee. Why did you?
I think it was
always interested in on the drivers. Why do you end up running a nonprofit working in water and sanitation somewhere in Malawi or whatever, right? Yeah. What is it that, is it incremental? Is it the subway conversation that we're back to, coming back to
it's
those?
It's before that. I think it relates to my time at Queen's University. There were a lot of young people thinking about the challenges of the world. Ken Wiwa came to campus, Marilyn Waring, the eminent feminist economist from New Zealand. We just had an incredible array of guests visit. Cornel West came. I mean, there were
one of my favorites.
So there were a bunch of critical thinkers that arrived at Queen's when I was there, and that was formative for sure.
I love how right in the first chapter you talk about I think just the practical side of I guess the challenges, but also, here it is. You have in your hands a book on cotton that aims to push you to think about politics.
Yeah.
So maybe, back to my original question, maybe it's not a book about cotton. Well, maybe it's really a little more subversive than the title suggests. Mm.
Well, I mean, the publisher was very happy that I'm pushing students to think through the implications of the politics at all levels. So we're talking about cotton on the land and the politics of that, or whether it's when countries get their hands on this stuff, how do they advance their interests? When businesses have their hands on it, big businesses, how does that, you know, what are the politics of that? And I do think there are some, you know, some messages that are in there related to cotton that could be applied across the economy to other particular commodities or resources, there's no question. So yeah, maybe there is a little bit of that there too. There's a political analysis, but there might be some politicking going on. But I think at least I'm straight up with my bias.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
that's
yes.
my that's the big problem with scholarship that's been rooted
arcane academic debates ringing a bell.
Yeah, that's it. So I think you know, being straight up about where the politics is situated in your own analysis, and then trying to peel that back and kind of through an analysis show where all this other politics is coming in. At least I'm open about it, and that's frustrating great. When people aren't open about
it. It's a fun book. It's a great book. Yep. The book is called Cotton. Adam Snaid, associate professor at the University of Guelph. Thanks for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks, David. Great show. Thank you.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.